WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. The desire to connect, it's a core drive for so many of us at work, with our friends, with our family. So why does it sometimes feel so hard? Well, in his new book, Super Communicators, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Charles Duhigg walks us through the steps to take to connect better, to communicate more effectively and more deeply. Drawing on the latest research in the fields of neuroscience and psychology, as well as some great storytelling, he explains how anyone, yes, anyone, can become a super communicator. You may know Charles Duhigg as the author of The Power of Habit, or Smarter, Faster, Better. He's been with the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and currently writes for The New Yorker. The full title of his new book is Super Communicators: How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. I started our conversation by acknowledging the elephant in the room, that me and Charles, well, we're both journalists, so we're supposed to be great communicators to begin with. I asked him to explain why, oh why, communication can be so hard sometimes. Here's Charles.
It absolutely is, and that was kind of one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that I had two experiences. The first was that at the New York Times, they made me a manager, and I was okay at the like logistics part, and I was terrible at the communication part. And then oftentimes I would come home and talk to my wife, and my wife would say something like, wait, you're supposed to be good at communication, right? Like, you're like, you're professional. What's going on?
The pressure.
And the pressure was huge. And I felt like there was something I was missing. And so I started talking to these researchers, and what they told me is, we're living through this golden age of understanding communication for really the first time because of advances in neuroscience and data collection. And they said, for the first time, we know how to unlock the parts of a conversation and make them better. And so that's why I wrote the book, is I wanted to share that with people.
Yeah. And early in the book, you list four rules. These are four rules for having meaningful conversations. One, pay attention to what kind of conversation is occurring. Two, share your goals and ask what others are seeking. Three, ask about others' feelings and share your own. And four, explore if identities are important to this discussion. Now, we'll get into all of them, but first I want to zoom in on the first one, because I don't know, Charles, that many people actually begin conversations knowing what type of dialogue they're seeking. So say more on that.
So this actually, the perfect illustration for this came from my own life, where I would come home after a long day at work and I would complain to my wife about my day and, you know, my boss is a jerk. And she very reasonably would try and solve my problem by saying, like, why don't you take your boss out to lunch and you guys can get to know each other? But instead of being able to hear what she was saying, I would get even more upset. I would say, like, why aren't you supporting me? Why aren't you outraged on my behalf? And then she would get upset that I was upset. And so when I talked to these researchers, they told me, well, look, here's the problem that's occurring, is that most people think a discussion is about one thing. It's about your day or about your kids' grades. But actually, every discussion is made up of different kinds of conversations. And most of those fall into one of three buckets. There's these practical conversations where we're solving problems or making plans. There's emotional conversations where I tell you what I'm feeling and I don't want you to solve it for me. I want you to empathize. And then there's social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other, how our social identities influence how we speak and hear. And they said, when in this situation, you were having an emotional conversation and your wife was having a practical conversation, and so you guys couldn't connect. This has led to what's known as the matching principle, which is you have to be having the same kind of conversation at the same time if you really want to align with each other.
Yeah. You write about reading a person's mood and energy and matching their mood and energy.
That's exactly right. Laughter is a great example of this. 80% of the time when we laugh, it is not in response to something funny.
Yeah.
It's because we're showing the other person we want to connect with them. And when they laugh back in the same basic energy, they're showing us that they want to connect with us in return.
I love that. And your example with your wife just leads me to, you know, my partner and I, we have this thing, it's been going for years, where we say, all right, do you want me to give you advice or am I just listening here? Right? It's like, are you?
You're a super communicator.
Is this just a vent session or? And often I'm like, just listen.
Just shut up and listen.
Just let me get it out.
And it feels good when someone asks you that, right? In schools, they've actually started teaching teachers to do this, that when a student is having an issue, they should ask them, do you want me to help you? Do you want me to hear you? Or do you want me to hug you? And of course, those are the three conversations, the practical, the emotional, and the social. But it feels good when someone asks us what we need or want out of a conversation, because sometimes we don't know ourselves until someone does ask.
Yeah. To that end, in super communicators, what is this really about? That's the important question that you touch on as well, because I can't tell you the number of times that I've talked with someone and it feels like the words I'm hearing, they're actually just scratching the surface of the real message that they're trying to convey.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And that that's usually happens at the start of a conversation. What's this really about? We're trying to figure out how we are going to talk to each other. Is it okay to tell jokes? Is it okay to interrupt? Or is this a very formal conversation? And we're trying to figure out what topics we both want to get to. Now, there's been a number of studies, including by some researchers at Harvard Business School, that found that people are very bad in general at picking up on the signals that somebody wants to talk about something differently. And it's oftentimes because we pay too much attention to the words coming out of their mouth instead of all the things around those words, including their tone of voice and their expression and how they're holding themselves. What we found is that oftentimes people fall into a habit of talking about what seems shallow. We're here to discuss next week's budget.
Yes.
But when in truth, what's going on underneath is, I'm really anxious because if we don't get this right, we're going to have to lay people off. And that really worries me. And so the way that we, what we want to do is we want to draw out those deeper topics. And there's an easy way to do this, which is known as asking deep questions.
You in the same realm, describe the quiet negotiation that we participate in, right? A subtle give and take over which topics we're going to dive into and what we're going to skirt around. Very similar to what you were just talking about. And to me, it does make the most sense in that work setting that you described. Meetings that have a clear agenda. You even write about a jury deliberation scenario in the book here as well. But how easy is it to miss this step in our personal conversations?
It's enormously easy. Or you're right, workplaces. In a workplace, sometimes it feels awkward to ask, like, what do you really want to talk about? Why are we really here? But that's where these deep questions are so useful. A deep question is something that asks someone to talk about their values or their beliefs or their experiences. And they're much easier to ask than you would think. And a lot of this work comes from Nicholas Epley, who's at the University of Chicago. You know, if you bump into someone and you say, oh, what do you do for a living? And they say, I'm a lawyer. A deep question might be, oh, what made you decide to go to law school? Or, you know, what do you love about practicing the law? Or at work, if someone says we need to talk about the budget, a deep question might be, what are your concerns about the budget? Or what do you make of the budget? That's an invitation for someone to say something real to you.
Those are great suggestions.
And when they do, that's when the negotiation starts. And we begin to understand what this person wants and how to share with them what we want.
Some of the best communicators I've come across in my personal life, as well as TV and radio, they're connecting with people deeply. What you're saying
Absolutely.
Makes total sense. They're really touching their hearts. You talk about the power of emotional intelligence, right?
Yeah.
And how understanding how people feel, that's also a key component of great communication. I think it comes easier to some than others, though, Charles. And so talk us through that, like the difficulty of channeling another person's feelings when you might have so much going on in your own life.
Yeah. No, it's a really good question. And the truth is, we think that emotions don't pop up in conversations unless we're crying or smiling. But the truth is, emotions influence every single conversation. They influence how we hear. They influence what we say. And so it's important to acknowledge those feelings and look for opportunities to do so. One of my favorite examples of this, and again, at the workplace, this is really true, is that you know, oftentimes before a meeting starts, you might be making conversation with the other people in the room and you say something like, oh, what'd you do this weekend? And they say, oh, you know, I went to my kid's graduation. It'd be very easy just to say, oh, congratulations. Oh, okay, now let's get down to business. But if you just take a second and you say, oh man, wait, like what did that feel like to like watch your kid walk across that stage? That's a deep question. It's an easy question to ask, but it's a deep question. And it gives the other person a chance to share their emotional experience with you. And when we are connected on an emotional level, it becomes much easier for us to have a practical conversation or to discuss something difficult or to give each other feedback. Mm-hmm. That emotional connection can happen just as easily as just acknowledging that someone said something and asking them how they feel.
Yeah. How many times do you walk by someone and they say, hey, how's it going? And you're like, good.
Yeah. Right.
Good. And you keep walking. No one made eye contact. We both just kept walking in our opposite directions. Did we accomplish anything from that conversation, that exchange? Not really, but we acknowledged each other. There's a plus.
Yeah. And it would take 10 seconds to be like, oh man, I'm doing okay. Like I had like a, you know, a good morning and I'm hoping for a good afternoon. How about you?
Yeah.
Right now, suddenly you're having a more real conversation. And again, it doesn't have to be long.
Right.
But it's that connection that, you know, when you're in a meeting together later on that day, you feel more trusting of each other. You like each other more.
Right.
It makes it easier.
In that scenario, I would just be afraid to get deep because by the time I start to respond, they're gone. As I said, they've already walked off.
You don't have to get deep all the time and you don't have to make everything into a conversation.
So
right?
I just go back to the default. Good.
That works too.
That works too. What else did you learn in this process, Charles, about what is going on in a person's brain when we're trying to see things from another person's perspective and truly understand them?
Yeah, it's really interesting. What we've learned, and again, this comes from the last decade, is that when you're in a conversation with someone, your body and your brain starts to change to match them. So right now, we're talking to each other and we're separated by thousands of miles. But if we could detect it, what we would find is that our pupils are starting to dilate at similar rates. Our breath patterns are starting to match each other. And most importantly, the activity within our brains, our neural activity, is starting to look similar. And that's what a conversation is. I describe a feeling or experience to you in such a way that you, in a part, also experience that same feeling or also experience that same idea. That's why we're able to connect with each other, is because our brains become aligned. Now, the question is, how do we do this? Why are some people better at it? And because some people are. Some people can connect with almost anyone.
Right.
These are known as super communicators. And it's often because they're paying attention to what the other person is sending them.
So they're not just born with it?
No. In fact, what we know is that anyone can become a super communicator because it's just a set of skills that you can learn. Most consistent super communicators, they actually tell you that when they were young, they had trouble making friends or their parents got divorced and they had to be the peacemaker. So they had to think a little bit more about communication than everyone else. And what a super communicator does that's really important is they show you that they want to connect with you. Because oftentimes that feels vulnerable, mm-hmm. that feels scary. But if we just ask someone, what did it feel like to watch your son walking across that stage? Or we laugh when they laugh, what we're showing them is, I want to connect with you. And that's all the invitation most people need.
Listening is so important too, right? Why do some people have a tough time really listening in conversation?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And a lot of the research has been done, particularly on situations where we're having hard conversations, right? Where there's some conflict or we disagree with each other. And what we found is that even if we're listening, the other person might not realize it. And in fact, in a tough conversation, in the back of our head, sometimes we're suspicious. Is this person listening or are they just waiting their turn to speak? So what we need to do is we need to prove that we're listening. And we do that by saying something after they finish talking. There's a technique known as looping for understanding that they teach at Harvard and Stanford and all kinds of places. And it has three steps. The first step is ask a question, preferably a deep question. The second step is once they've answered that question, repeat back in your own words what that person has said. And then finally, and this is what most people forget, ask if you got it right. Now, we've all experienced this, right? Somebody looping us and proving that they heard what we said.
Yes.
And it feels amazing. You feel like you want to listen to them because they've obviously listened to you.
Yes, but I've also experienced the opposite, where I can absolutely tell you are not listening to anything I just said.
That's exactly right. Right. And it feels terrible. It feels like you can't trust this person. Now, sometimes we can't listen because we're in our own heads too much. And that's why looping for understanding is really useful as well, is because if my assignment in this conversation is to repeat back to you what you said in my own words, or to ask you a follow-up question that shows that I'm processing this, I have to pay attention to you. I can't get in my own head because I have this assignment. I gotta make note of what you're saying so I can say it back.
Absolutely. This one might be tough to put a number on, Charles, but after researching and writing the book, how much of communication would you say is actually non-linguistic? Like this is something you get into in the book when talking about NASA, of all places.
Yeah. So about half of our conversations do not involve words. Now, they're not necessarily nonverbal, right? They might involve noises we make, or they might involve, our tone of voice, or they might be nonverbal. They might be our expressions or how we hold our body. And you're exactly right. One of my favorite stories from the book is about NASA, because in the early 1980s, NASA decided they needed more astronauts who had emotional intelligence. But the problem is they couldn't figure out of the candidates who actually had emotional intelligence and who faked it really, really well.
Oh.
And so one of the psychologists, he realized that if he paid attention to how people laugh, that he would be able to figure out who wants to connect with him. So what he would do is he would walk into a room holding a bunch of papers and he would spill them as if on accident when it was actually on purpose. And then he would laugh this huge laugh. Ha, 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 ha. And then he'd pay attention. Did the candidate he was about to interview, did they chuckle back politely? Because we all know we're supposed to laugh if someone else laughs. Or did they match him? Did they laugh too and say, I'm sorry, here, let me help you pick those up. The people who laugh back the same way, they're the ones who want to connect. They're the ones with emotional intelligence. They're showing us that they understand something happened that was just that was a little bit vulnerable, and they're matching our vulnerability and making it okay.
I love that example so much.
It's wonderful, isn't it? And now if anyone applies to NASA, they know. Laugh the
just
same
laugh.
Way that they interviewed it, right?
Laugh your way through the entire interview. Well, I mean, on the flip side, some of the toughest conversations that we have, I mean, they come during times of high conflict.
Yeah.
What strategies would you say you learned about communicating in stressful situations or communicating when people disagree with you strongly?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. And the first is that looping for understanding. That's a really powerful tool when you're in conflict with someone. But the second thing is to try and define what the goal of this conversation is. And oftentimes we go into a conversation thinking, my goal is to convince you of something. My goal is to make you listen to me, because then I think you'll agree with me. But the goal of a conversation ought to be just simply to understand each other, for you to understand me and for me to understand you. And even if we walk away still disagreeing with each other, but we understand each other, then that conversation is a success. And one of the elements of that is figuring out what we're trying to control. Because when we're in conflict, oftentimes we have an urge for control and we try and control the other person. We say, like, I'm not going to talk about that. Or or we try and control their emotions and say, oh, you felt that? You shouldn't have felt. You shouldn't have been upset. That wasn't worth getting upset about.
Mm-hmm.
What's much better, and we know this from marriage therapy, studies of marriage therapy, is instead of trying to control the other person, take that urge for control and control things together, like the environment. If a fight starts at 2 a.m, say, okay, look, let's wait until 10 when we're both well-rested and the sun's up. Or if a fight starts about where we're going to go for Thanksgiving, and it could easily spill over to your mother hates me and we don't have enough money, what researchers refer to as kitchen sinking, which is toxic in a relationship.
Absolutely.
Let's control together the boundaries of this discussion. Let's say we're just going to talk about Thanksgiving, no talking about money. When we're controlling something together, even if we disagree with each other, we feel like we can make progress.
Yeah.
And that's important.
I love that. I especially don't do well when someone tries to control when we have the discussion.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about it right now. Well, maybe I'm not ready to talk about it right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it feels like they're trying to control you instead of asking permission, saying, look, would you like to talk about this now? Or would it be better if we waited a couple of hours so we can kind of get our thoughts in order? You know, and my guess is, and tell me if this is wrong, you'd mentioned your partner.
Yes.
And it sounds like you guys have pretty good communication habits.
We do. But it wasn't always that way.
Yeah.
It didn't start that way.
And was it something you deliberately worked on? Did you talk about we need to communicate better?
Yes, because I am a natural communicator. It was very important for me to understand why we weren't seeing eye to eye in some situations where I knew very well that, oh my gosh, there's a solution here. I can see it. It's over there. For some reason, we can't arrive at that same place. And so I would sort of slow it down and sort of gently ask, you know, when we could talk about something and try my best not to control. I was the person trying to talk about it right now. Right. And I realized, okay, no, he needs time. And then when he comes totally collected, we have the best conversation. And I forget what the conflict was even about.
And what I love about your example is that it ties so much into what we know, which is that we are born with the ability to be super communicators. We're born with the ability to communicate. Mm-hmm. Communication is Homo sapiens' superpower. Yeah. It is what has caused us to succeed as a species so well. And we have these instincts. Evolution has given us these instincts on how to communicate. But sometimes we can forget them, right? Sometimes when we're talking online to someone, we can forget how important it is to be a little bit polite, right? Instead of screaming. And so one of the things that in writing Super Communicators I tried to do is take all this recent science and say, look, here are the skills and tools that we know super communicators use. And they are skills and tools that will feel very natural to you because your brain has evolved to default into this. You just need to be reminded of them sometimes until they become habits.
Yeah. How does technology get in a super communicator's way?
Well, it doesn't have to. And the answer is that we have to recognize that different forms of communication have different rules, and it's easy to forget that. One of my favorite examples of this is that about 100 years ago, when phones first became popular, there were all these papers saying, no one will ever use a phone for a real conversation because you can't see each other. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they were right. If the transcripts of those early conversations are stilted, and people are just kind of using it to give stock orders or grocery orders to each other, like a telegraph. But by the time you and I and everyone else were teenagers, we could talk on the phone for like 7 hours at a stretch, right?
Absolutely.
And it's because we learned how to use telephones. We learned that there's different rules. When you're talking to someone on the phone, even if you don't realize it, you tend to over-enunciate your words. You put more emotion in your voice because you know that they can't see you. Now, the problem is that online, we've been talking to each other for like maybe 20 years. And when it comes to Slack and emojis and what my kids do on their phone, mm-hmm. like that's 3 years old. I don't even understand it. And so as a result, we don't know those rules quite as well. And it's easy in the speed of a day to forget that talking to someone online, talking to someone via an email versus a text versus a phone call, they all require something slightly different.
Yes.
And if we don't remind ourselves of that, then we treat an email like a face-to-face conversation. And we say something sarcastic, assuming they can hear the sarcasm in our voice. Mm-hmm. And of course, they can't.
Tell me more about the process of putting super communicators together. How much of this was research versus just your awesome storytelling skills and lived experience?
Thank you. It was mostly reporting, right? Because I'm a reporter from the New York Times, now the New Yorker, I spent about 3 years talking to researchers and going into laboratories and talking to people who are super communicators. One of my favorite stories in the book is about this CIA officer who, when he first gets hired, is absolutely terrible at his job. It's his job to recruit overseas spies. And everyone he tries to recruit in Europe is like, nope, not going to do it. I'm going to report you to the authorities and get you deported. So then he eventually meets this one woman who's in town from the Middle East. She works for her country's foreign ministry. She's on vacation. He gets to know her a little bit. He tells her he works for the CIA and he wants to work with her. And she just panics. She says, like, in my country, they kill people for that. And so he convinces her to have one more dinner with him. And in the dinner, it becomes clear, this is hopeless. He's not going to be able to recruit this woman. In fact, he's going to get fired because he's just terrible at this job. And so he just gives up and he decides to be as honest as he could be and say, right. He tells her, like, look, I understand that you're scared to go home because you feel disappointed in yourself. I feel disappointed in myself too, because I'm so bad at this job. And it's when they're both vulnerable with each other that they can hear and trust each other. And it's at that moment that she says, okay, I'm willing to work with you. And she becomes the best asset in the Middle East for the next 20 years. But it's only because they engaged in this reciprocal authenticity, because they were vulnerable with each other. Mm. And that's what we need to do in all of our conversations when we can.
Absolutely. Who comes to mind for you, Charles, when you think of someone who's really good at making meaningful conversation? And then what makes them so good?
So I'm going to ask you a question and the listeners too, because I think that the answer will pop in your head. When you're having a bad day, and you want to call someone who you know will make you feel better,
mm-hmm.
do you know who you would call?
Absolutely.
Who is it?
One of my best friends. Her name's Abena.
Abena. So Abena for you is a super communicator.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're probably a super communicator for her. You yes. guys know how to connect with each
Just
other.
Just last week, Charles.
It's wonderful, isn't it? It feels yes. so good.
Yes.
And
yes.
my guess is that Abena is not like the most charismatic friend you have or the most extroverted friend you have. She might not even be like the smartest or most successful friend you have, but she knows how to connect with you.
Yeah, she's there when I need her. Her timing. She's a busy individual. She's a very successful woman. She's not as much of an extrovert as I am, so she's not on social media. She doesn't take part in any of that stuff. But I know those 10 digits to dial when I'm in need, and she's the one for sure.
It feels like a lifeline, right?
Yes, and she breaks things down to me in a way that I just hadn't thought of.
She knows how to listen to you. She knows how to prove that she's listening to you. She knows how to ask you the right questions, the deep questions mm-hmm. that help you understand what's going on. So when you ask me, like, who is a super communicator I can point to, there's lots. There's like Barack Obama, right? And Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan. There's these high profile super communicators. But the most meaningful ones are actually the people in our own life.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, Abena probably is that person with many, many different others. Right. She probably knows how to do this. And there are these folks who are consistent super communicators. And it's not because they're more charismatic. It's not because they're more bigger extroverts. It's simply because they've learned a couple of skills
mm-hmm.
and they think like half an inch deeper about how communication works.
I found it fascinating in the who are we section of super communicators. You dove into how we bring our social identities to conversations, like our backgrounds, our families, the causes that we believe in. Break down for me your definition of social identities in this context, because it's more than just I'm black and you're white. I'm pro-gun right. and you're anti-gun. I'm an immigrant, you're not.
In fact, it has to be more than that for us to have a meaningful conversation. Because the truth is that all of us contain multiple identities. And it's when we acknowledge those identities in a conversation that we bring our full selves to the discussion. If I started a conversation, I said, you know, you're black and I'm white, and so I wonder how you think about policing. That would be so reductionist, right? Like it's already pushing you and me both into these stereotypes
right.
that is limited. But if I say, you know, you're a black woman and I know that you have a partner and I know that you're a reporter, and so you probably hear from both victims and perpetrators of violence. And I imagine that you've grown up in places where you know cops, maybe even related to a cop, or maybe you've seen the cops impact your family's life.
Mm-hmm.
By introducing all of those different identities into the conversation, when I say, what do you think about policing? What I'm doing is I'm giving both of us the opportunity not to be shallow, not to be seen through the lens of a stereotype, but rather to say, you know, the truth is I have complicated thoughts about this because I see it from so many different perspectives. That's what a social conversation does really well when it succeeds.
I love that because as I read that section of the book, I was thinking, all right, Charles, but many people find it difficult to trust that other person, especially if we don't see eye to eye, right?
Yeah.
And they don't think like me. So how do I even break the ice in that circumstance?
I think a lot of it is simply acknowledging, right? It's very often that we do not acknowledge our differences in a conversation. The fact that you're black and I'm white, that we don't bring that up, even if we're talking about a topic like race, where it's really important. And so sometimes just acknowledging it, but acknowledging all the different identities that someone possesses, not just one of them, that says to someone, look, I see you. Like, I see that you are a black woman and you're also a professional and you're a journalist and you're someone who is in a relationship where it sounds like you guys really learn to communicate with each other. You are a complex person. And at that point, I can say, look, given your experiences that are different from mine, how do you see the world differently? I want to understand.
Yeah, I love that. Another example in the book that I thought was pretty timely, you wrote about how a doctor named Jay Rosenblum, how he navigated talking about as well as recommending vaccinations to his patients. Now, this is, you know, this goes back to the late 90s. But I want you to talk a bit more about his story and how it relates to what we've learned about the psychology of vaccine resistance, right? Or so-called anti-vaxxers from this COVID era.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, a lot of what we know really became important during COVID, because obviously there were a lot of people who chose not to get the vaccine.
Right.
And initially, the National Institutes of Health, what they told doctors was, oh, just give them the facts. If you give them the facts, then they'll change their mind. They'll understand that this vaccine is safe. And all the doctors said, no, you don't understand. They've been on the internet for 100 hours. They know all of the facts. Like, there's nothing I can tell them. They might believe different facts than I do, but I'm not going to convince them my facts are right and theirs are wrong. Because if I do that, I'm entering into these very shallow identities, right? I'm a doctor, so I know better. You're an ignorant patient, so you don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So then the advice changed, and this is what was successful, is they started saying, use this technique known as motivated interviewing. And it corresponds to what we were just talking about. Coming into a room and saying, listen, I know that you don't want the vaccine, but I also know that you're a grandfather and you worry a lot about your kid's health. Tell me what you make of the best way for us to protect you and to protect your family. And then just listen and show you're listening. And what they found is that if they did this, instead of making an argument, instead of trying to convince, they proved to the person that they want to understand them, then at that point, the person became much more amenable to hearing different perspectives. That's how you got it. That's how doctors got anti-vaxxers to get the shot, was not by trying to give them facts or trying to prove something to them. It was by listening, genuinely listening to why they didn't want it in the first place and what their worries were.
This part was truly, truly eye-opening. Zooming out, what do you think we lose? What do we lose out on when we don't have meaningful conversations with other people?
We lose a lot. You know, one of the largest studies of human happiness is known as the Harvard study of adult development. It's been going on for almost 100 years, and they followed thousands of people through their lives. And they found that the single greatest determinant of whether you're healthy and happy at age 65 is if you have strong connections to at least two or three other people when you're age 45.
That's it.
And of course, there's nothing magic about 45. It's just that, you know, by then you've sort of built up these relationships. People who don't have strong relationships with others, they get sicker faster. In fact, the Surgeon General just said that loneliness is the equivalent of 15 cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
They're much less happy. And so the question becomes, how do we establish these connections? How do we develop those relationships with a small handful of people or a large number of people that are really genuine connections? And the answer is almost through conversation. And it doesn't matter how frequently that conversation happens. One of my closest friends, I talk to him on the phone every 6 months. And we get updated on each other's life. Yeah, 6 months. 6 months goes by. He lives abroad. He's busy. I'm busy.
Wow. I thought when my friends and I go 1 month, I feel terrible.
Right.
6 months?
But different people have different needs, right? And different patterns we fall into. But what matters is that when we talk to each other, it's a real conversation. Mm-hmm. We feel connected to each other. I know that he's one of my best friends, even if I haven't checked in with him lately.
Yeah.
We lose a lot when we don't know how to have conversations with each other.
My mom would say, it's like you didn't skip a beat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it feels so good, right?
Yeah.
Our brains have actually evolved to crave connection. That's what helped us build families and then villages and then communities. We want that connection. And the key to it is just learning how to have real conversations. And the good news is, anyone can do it. It's just a set of skills that are pretty easy to make into habits.
That's Charles Duhigg. His new book, Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. It's out today and it's available wherever books are sold. Thank you so much for joining us, Charles.
Thank you for having me on.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Dan Tucker and me, and it was mixed by Micah Yason and Brenda Ruiz. Now, if you'd like to communicate with Reset a little bit more, I won't blame you. One way to get in touch and learn the latest is the Reset Daily Newsletter. It includes breakdowns of the big local news in Chicago, a list of what's coming up, great recommendations for things to do around the Chicago area, and thanks to our Sound Off section, it's a great way to offer your ideas and feedback to the Reset team. Now, if you're interested, give it a try by going to wbez.org/resetnews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.